Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So Meg Wolitzer, maybe you know the name, has been writing about work, family, and women's lives in her finely observed novels for over two decades. Her latest novel, The 10-Year Nap, begins as the protagonist is waking up. Meg Wolitzer, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much.
And for people who used to listen to the show The Next Big Thing, they may not only know you as a novelist, but also as a sometimes radio contributor.
Yeah, I love doing that.
Would you read the opening paragraph of The 10-Year Nap?
Sure. All around the country, the women were waking up. Their alarm clocks bleated one by one, making soothing sounds or grating sounds or the stirrings of a favorite song. There were hums and beeps and a random burst of radio. There were wind chimes and roaring surf and the electronic approximation of birdsong and other gentle animal noises. All of it accompanied the passage of time, sliding forward in liquid crystal. Almost everything in these women's homes required a plug. Voltage stuttered through the curls of wire, and if you put your ear to one of the complicated clocks in any of the bedrooms, you could hear the burble of industry deep inside its cavity. Something was quietly happening.
So that's the literal waking up. That's the alarm clock moment in the morning, yes?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And is it metaphorical as well?
Oh, yes. You know, when I named my book The 10-Year Nap, I recognized that it was something of an edgy title that seemed maybe judgmental. I didn't mean it that way, I have to say.
And it refers to the 10 years that many women stay home before re-entering full-time the workforce?
Exactly. I had really only read books in which the sort of dialogue was about the debate between working or staying home when your child is very young. But I was interested in what happens when that period goes on longer than you think initially. People, I knew women who had left jobs planning to go back, and suddenly 1 year became two, and suddenly the child had his own cohort or her own cohort, and the mothers were left to think, what do I want to do with my life now? And that was something that seemed interesting to me. So for me, the 10-year nap is about the idea of waking up, not from some sleep of idleness at all, but sort of the moment when you kind of look in the mirror and say, you know what, I did a good job with my kid. He or she is out in the world. I'm staying home, but not necessarily with the kid anymore.
At least until 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And the novel's main character, Amy Lamb, in your words, quote, willingly exchanged the law firm for the long and astonishing inhalation of motherhood, which itself over time had gradually been exhaled, unquote. So is that to say that this particular cohort of women that you're writing about is often not working but not happy about their choice or with their lives?
I think that what I realized over the course of writing the book, it wasn't so much that I came down on the side of work versus or not work. I really didn't. It wasn't my place to have a position as a novelist. But what I understood talking to a lot of people and just thinking about it is that people want a sense of purpose. They want a sense of purpose of some kind or other, and that can involve staying home and that can involve work. But when there's less to do at home, I think that there can be a restlessness, absolutely.
So, listeners, you want to get in on this? Does this sound like you? Do you have a question for Meg Wolitzer? Do you recognize yourself so far in the 10-year nap? Are you in the process of, quote, waking up? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Does this harken back to Betty Friedan, a kind of is this all there is sense of the stay-at-home wife and mother?
Everything harkens back to Betty Friedan in a lot of ways, doesn't it? But, you know, I think really the notion, for me, the notion that I thought about a lot was that idea that I kind of grew up with, which is that you can have it all. And I find that that is a fallacious idea. Really, somebody said to me once, you know, you can have a lot of many things. And I think that's maybe a more realistic way of thinking about life. But I was one of these kids who grew up with a mother who was, a feminist in that wave of feminism in the 70s. I grew up reading Stories for Free Children and Ms. Magazine. And I, in fact, when I became an adolescent, I ran a consciousness-raising group in my living room. And we wrote away to the National Organization of Women asking for topics that we could use. And they sent back things like sexual freedom and you, when all we really wanted were topics like when your mom doesn't understand. So for me, it all does go back to early feminism, yeah.
You told the New York Times that before you wrote this novel, you judged stay-at-home mothers. What was your moment of epiphany?
It wasn't one moment. It was many moments that went, you know, got put together. I had spent a lot of time with women who I'd met through my kids' school. I think that's when a lot of it happens. Before then, I didn't really know women who didn't work before I had kids. And it's not, I think that there is this fake divide and fake kind of fist fight that the media sometimes inflates between women who work and women who don't, or women who have kids and women who don't. I don't see that. But everybody I knew was on some sort of ambitious track for themselves. And then suddenly when I had kids, I met women I really liked who were just as funny as the ones I'd always liked, but they had stopped working. I didn't know them when they worked. And I started talking to them and hearing about their lives. Some had misgivings about it. Some felt really, really frustrated. I ended up realizing that I'd been, you know, a little bit elitist thinking that I had made it work. A writer, you know, a writer's job allows a lot of this because you have one foot, you know, well, you have one foot on a banana peel. You have one hand on a keyboard and you have one hand on the rattle. You can sort of stay at home and work a little bit. But most jobs aren't like that at all.
So what was your story? You have, how many kids do you have?
I have two kids.
And being a writer, an independent, I guess it wasn't in the workforce or out of the workforce, but you can't really have one hand on the rattle and write a novel, can you?
You know what happened really is that my writing, I think, became stronger with a novel of mine called The Wife when I had kids because my time was more valuable to me. I remember a period in my life when my husband and I sort of were these sloths. We would sleep really late and watch game shows. Like, when I think about that now, I want that time back. I'm mortal. I'm, you know, I have an existential crisis thinking about it. I'm not getting that time back. But now it's like the kids' eyelids flutter shut and a nap is beginning and I'm writing.
Meg Wolitzer, my guest on WNYC, her new book, The 10-Year Nap, begins as the protagonist is waking up, literally, in the morning. Let's take some phone calls. Our lines are full. I think we can get a pretty interesting discussion going. We could put all of these 10 callers on together and leave, Meg, you know?
That's fine. Maybe they can have a consciousness.
It would probably be great. Jean in Palisades Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jean.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
What I wanted to say was I actually had one daughter. She started high school last year, and when she finally went into high school, I went back and to school myself and got a culinary degree, and now I'm doing catering. And before I had my daughter, I was in the corporate world, and I knew that wasn't something I wanted to do again. And when I was home, I would have parties or children's parties or do things, and it finally dawned on me this is something that I can make a career of.
So here's my question to you.
Uh-huh.
You said this was when your daughter turned 16, right?
Yes.
What happened between 6 and 16?
Actually, I was quite busy. I did a lot of volunteer work for her school. I did volunteer work in neighborhood. I did do catering part-time here and there whenever friends of mine were doing jobs. So I kept myself actually quite busy. I have elderly parents that I drove to and from all over the place. I was their cab. So I was really quite busy. It's actually easier for me to go to work than it is to stay home.
I think that's great that you were able to marshal what you love to do and make it into, you know, work that's really meaningful. I think it's wonderful. You know, nobody is napping during that time period at all. Everybody's observing. It's not just novelists.
Sophia in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sophia.
Hi there. I work a 3-day work week so that I can be mommy. But I've been a mother for almost 20 years now. But every time I think that I'm getting things to a place where my older son, who happens to have dyslexia, to where he's, you know, somewhat independent, I wound up having to go right back to, you know, doing things for him. So all my ambitions seem to have been put aside for now. And I'm waiting to wake up from that 10-year nap.
You know, a lot of jobs really aren't responsive to people's needs. I find that with corporate America, you see that a great deal. And I really, really wish that that would change. And I hope it does for you.
Well, the corporate situation I'm in now, fortunately enough, is something that's very, it's not as bad as it used to be. I mean, there was a time where it just seemed that that it was much more hostile environment, but not so much now. Now it just seems, what seems to be the case is that the education system for my son's situation and the support for people who have just learning disabilities happens to be such a maze that that's a second full-time job in itself. And that's where my problems come in.
Sophia, thanks a lot for your call. Ellen Westchester is finding this a little judgmental. Elle, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, hello.
So?
Thank you for having my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know, I didn't read a book, I'm going to read it. I wanted to know what kind of terms are you using, because I'm trying to even define myself as a stay-at-home mom. I definitely don't stay home. I just don't go to a work outside. And then a full-time mom, I even heard that it's kind of offensive to someone who's working. I'm not full-time mom. So how do I even work out with those kind of terms?
Well, what words do you think describe yourself?
Well, I'm a full-time caregiver of my two daughters. Looking for something part-time to do. I actually had a great excuse because I came to the U.S. without a work permit, and came pregnant. So I knew I can't really have a choice.
Right.
I know what you mean about this, because nobody wants to be defined by a term. In fact, I use very few of these terms in my novel, because what I just wanted to show was what it's like for women. What is it like dealing with these questions of leaving work, staying at home? But you're right. These terms don't fully ever define who people are.
Elle, good luck. And you write about the vocabulary of motherhood, the way certain words creep into usage. Quote, you had to say play date. And you had to say it without irony.
Right. Yeah, irony. I found that irony sometimes is the first thing to go. And maybe it should be at times. But yes, there have been these words that have entered the lexicon. Playdate and juice box are two in particular. Sippy cup is another one, although that one, I don't know if it's made it into the new Webster's.
I'll bet Sippy Cup has. I've heard it a million times in my career as a parent. One of your earlier novels, The Wife, is about a woman whose professional identity is subsumed by her husband. You also wrote a book called Sleepwalking, refers back to the nap, perhaps, and This Is Your Life, seem to share a similar philosophy. Can we see your writing as, on one level, a cautionary tale for women?
I would never want to write a book that was like a handbook. I think one of the things that fiction does best is just show you the possibilities. I would never want to say to someone, this is how you should live. This is the way I think you should live. But I do think that if you look at my novels, there's certainly an emphasis on women's lives today and what they're like, and about sometimes the sort of uneasy tensions between men and women or within a family. Absolutely.
Ellen in New City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
I found it so interesting, you know, this topic today, only because I sort of think you should call it The Awakening.
That was taken by Kate Chopin.
It just seems that, you know, I'm 46, my oldest is 20, he's a sophomore in college, my youngest is 13, and I'm still in the soccer mom, travel soccer kind of thing going, where I am completely absorbed by my kids' schedules with sports and everything, and I'm almost apologizing to people that I don't work. I do work about 12 hours a week for a friend in a contracting firm, and I have a BA, I went to college. It's just almost you're embarrassed to say that you don't work, especially where I live, a very affluent community, and, you know, the double income people, and, you know, people my age now are, you know, paying off their mortgage, where I've been living on my house not to work, and they're buying their beach houses, and we're still, you know, and we're not in there, but I turn around and I look at the three children that I, you know, and I don't have the issues with learnings and, you know, disabilities. I have very healthy, productive, bright kids, but I still, that was my choice. I chose not to go back to work. But at the point now where I'm ready and I'm smart and I'm able, there's not really anything out there for me to be able to still take care of these kids who aren't driving, who need to go back. And my house is the hangout house where I have 15 to 17 teenagers every summer, every weekend from college and, you know, high school, hanging out at my house. And, you know, I look back at this at the time when they were younger, and I think about it now. It's almost that I need to be home more now than I did then.
You know, it probably doesn't need saying, but kids with learning disabilities also are usually healthy, productive, and bright.
So I'm just going to throw that in.
But your kids are school age, and I wonder.
Older. Yeah.
Yeah. So is the reason for you? And you say you're having trouble figuring out what work to go back to. But before you even get to that point, is it that you want to be around from 3 to 6? Is this all about 3 to 6, the choice you've made over the last, you know, maybe 10 years?
Oh, there's no doubt. And, you know, I'm not saying that part of the reason my kids haven't gotten in trouble and I know where they are. That's a huge, especially coming where I come from. And you think because it's an affluent community that, you know, that in school's so important that you don't have these troubles. It's like very bad around here with drugs and alcohol. And yeah, that's a choice I made. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to be able to drive my kids to their sports and be able to let them do these things. And of course, as I said, it's been a sacrifice. We live paycheck to paycheck. It's not
right.
Something that, you know, I've been blessed to do and we've had money to do it. It's been a self-sacrificing choice that my husband
right.
and I have made.
Right. Ellen, I'm going to leave it there. And Meg, how much does the character, the protagonist in the book, Amy Lamb, deal with the 3 to 6 question? Is it all about 3 to 6? Once your kids are school age, then if you're choosing not to go to the workforce, then is it all about 3 to 6?
Well, I'm sitting here thinking there should be a 3 to 6 revolution. There should be this 3 to 6 movement where women rise up as one and say, you know, we need to be home 3 to 6. Give us a job if we want it. But I think it's more than that. I mean, Amy in the book talks about loving those hours of 3 to 6. It's not just that she has to be there. They're a very beautiful time. I think there's great profundity between mothers and children, and
yeah.
I wanted to write about that because yeah. I feel that often the only thing you really see about mothers and kids and work and that stuff is in a book that's kind of polemical, that takes a position and shows statistics, or something that kind of mocks them. And as you can see from these callers, these lives are complicated. Although I would say to that woman, you know, travel soccer will kill you. Get out now.
It's also a matter of time, even if you're not doing travel soccer, because if somebody's working, even as a teacher, let's say, and
yeah.
getting home at 3 o'clock with the kids, at some point, the shopping has to get done, the laundry has to get
right.
done, everything else. And, you know, a lot of, quote, stay-at-home moms say, I don't know how I can go back to work. It's everything is a full-time job as it is.
Everybody is tired, whether they work in a job or not. Everyone feels right now that things are too much, and I think they're all trying to make it work somehow.
We'll continue in a minute with Meg Wolitzer. Her new book is called The 10-Year Nap. A lot of you want to speak, including some men who are calling up, and Clayton in Manhattan, you're going to be our next call. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with novelist Meg Wolitzer. Her new book is called The 10-Year Nap. How much did you identify with Amy's mother, Antonia, who says, quote, work is anti-death?
For me, work really is anti-death.
What does that mean?
It means that I want to, you know, put a little asterisk next to the word work there. And at the bottom of the page, you'd read, work can be defined as something that you do that is a project that is very meaningful to you. It doesn't have to be for pay. For me, it does have to be for pay because I have to work to support my kids. But, you know, I think the idea really is that having something that you love to do makes your life meaningful. And it's very clear to me that that's true for me.
And that could be childcare or something outside.
Absolutely. It could be whatever it is.
Clayton in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Clayton.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I couldn't wait to get on this program. I have a long-winded statement before I ask my question, but I'm a musician. My hours are pretty flexible. I married my wife in 2003. We had our daughter in 2004. And it's backwards. But in any event, I was staying at home with our daughter for the first 2 years of her life. A couple of years after that, we decided together that I would go to work full time during the day and work at night as a musician, and she would stay home raising our daughter. That was fine for the first year until things started to get more and more expensive. As everybody knows, living in Manhattan is really, really expensive. And basically, I asked her to go back to work in February of 2006. Some of the things that you said before, and I've heard other women say, is that, you know, I chose to stay home. Well, she chose to stay home against our wishes, basically, to work together as a family, and that's kind of led us to where we are right now, which is going through a divorce because
What do you mean stayed home against our wishes?
Well, stayed home against my wishes because I could not afford to work the schedule that I was working, and I couldn't afford to support the family with the income that I was making, so I needed her to go back to work to help out financially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she didn't want to do that?
She did not want to do that, and to this day, she still does not want to do that, and we're halfway through our divorce right now. I'm basically getting everything I deserve. But in the long run is that she chose not to go back to work, which is not helping out me, it's not helping out her, it's not helping out our two children now that we have. And the basic thing is, first of all, I'd just like to say there are a lot of men out here that can take care of children, too, so we can
stay
home and raise our children,
but
too.
You know, men don't. Clayton, I'm going to get a reaction for you from Meg. I mean, he has a particular story, but maybe this is a kind of conflict that comes up from time to time. Maybe the husband, the father, is more concerned about the money coming in. I mean, it could be with either spouse, I would imagine. One is more concerned about the money coming in, but Clayton, you never thought about you staying home from, well, you wanted both of you to work, but the men don't stay home. And he said the men could do it too, but men don't. You know, Meg, you may know this, that in Sweden, where they have a paid parental leave policy mandated by the government nationwide, what they found was that only women were doing it. Either parent could avail themselves of it, and only women were doing it by and large. Mm-hmm. And so they actually changed the law so that you lose a certain percentage of your paid parental leave if the man doesn't take it. I think the father has to take at least 20% of the available time, the year or whatever it is. And that was the only way they started to get men into that choice.
That's really interesting. I think, you know, the story of men and the 10-year nap, the story of men really in this period of time and working or not working hasn't been told yet. I think for a lot of men out there like you, there is a frustration about when do I get to say, you know, this is what I want. I don't get that kind of choice. And it's true. When we talk about staying home versus going to work, we are really mostly talking about women. It's changing a little bit. But one thing that's really clear is that in order for it to work, for one person not to work, there has to be enough money in a family, and it has to be a family decision, absolutely.
And here's another post from a man on the website which says, why do you feel this discussion is specific to mothers? What about fathers? We go through the same dilemma.
I think that's absolutely true. I think it started a little later because, you know, feminism and all kinds of change, social movements take a little longer than a generation, I think, to really fully take effect. And the men I'm seeing who are staying home are not my age. They're younger. They're in their 30s. It's taken a little bit longer, but that's absolutely happening more and more with men.
It's interesting. The first two posts on our webpage about this. One of them says, it is okay to stay at home to nurture the child. Why is a job considered more valuable? And the second post is, well, I think if all you have is a job, then that might be true. But for women with careers or who want careers, they probably want to be defined as something being more than just Billy's mom. And I feel like that's an eternal conversation that women have been having, primarily women have been having since the 70s.
Well, I've spoken to women who say that they feel embarrassed, and an earlier caller had spoken about this, when somebody says, as they often do at a dinner party or a cocktail party or somewhere in New York, what do you do? That horrible question. And you have to say, I stay home with my kids, and you can almost see the eyes roll up in the head. That kind of assumes that the guy who works in marketing at Revlon or wherever is more interesting than the woman who stays at home just because he works. You know, there are a lot of boring people and there are a lot of interesting people, but work does not make you interesting. Interesting work can.
Your book is a novel. You're a storyteller. How much do you follow the nonfiction Mommy Wars? Have you read, say, Get to Work, A Manifesto for Women of the World by Linda Hirschman?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I've tried to really stay outside the Mommy Wars. I'm kind of, you know, I'm Switzerland.
You're Switzerland.
Yeah, I'm the Switzerland. I'm the neutral one in the mommy wars.
Right.
Because otherwise, why would I want to throw myself into that fire? There's a lot of passion there about it. What a novelist can do, and what I hadn't seen done before I wrote The 10-Year Nap, is just say what it's like, what I've seen. That's all.
Jason in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jason.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say, I haven't read the book, so I'm sorry about that. But for me, my 10-year nap was really when I was working. And I felt like I was waking up when my wife and I decided that I would stay home, which I've been doing for, 3 or 4 years now.
And so it's you feel like you're waking up.
The
nap was being in the paid workforce.
Yeah, and it's not even that I didn't enjoy what I was doing. I just didn't have a balanced life. And now that, we're lucky enough that my wife makes enough money that I can stay home, but I feel like as a family we've been able to really kind of wake up all together and experience life more fully.
Is she jealous of you?
You know, I ask her this every once in a while, and she obviously is on a certain level, but the thing, it works really well for us. She really enjoys working, and I really enjoy being home with the kids.
How old are your kids?
6 and 4.
Jason, good luck. And Carolyn Armonk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Brian. I have to tell you that I love your show.
Thank you.
My comment to your screener was that I feel like I've just gone down for the 10-year nap. I worked until my kids were going into high school and middle school, and at that point decided it was more important for me to be around them now that they're older and need a parent as opposed to somebody just to make sure that they're safe and okay and give them a snack, when they get home from school. But they really need parenting in terms of values and, feelings and emotions and everything that adolescents go through. So I've just gone down for the nap, and when I wake up, I hope to do something completely different than what I did before I went to sleep.
So do you actively try to engage your teenage kids in discussions of feelings and their day? Because, a lot of teenagers come home, and the last thing they want to do is hang out with their mom.
Absolutely, but living in suburbia, I have this thing called a car, and they're a captive audience. And it's one-on-one time or two-on-one time, and I turn off the radio and I, make sure that their earphones from their iPod can be easily pulled out, and I try to engage them, and it is work, but, I can get there sometimes.
Have you been there, Meg?
I think I have teenagers right now, so I am there. I think that everybody should basically sort of program their own voice into their children's iPod. They'll be listening to something and suddenly, this is your mom speaking. How was your day? What happened? Did you get that test back? There's a way to do it.
Carol, thank you very much. You write that Amy, the main mother protagonist in your novel, seemed to wonder if accomplished women have been, quote, struck by a thunderbolt of purpose, unquote. So is the moral of this book sort of find what you're passionate about and do it, or is it more complicated than that?
I don't think it has a moral, and I don't think, again, that's a little, it would be too handbooky to sort of say that you should therefore read this book and go out and do it. But I wanted to show that, there's 4 different women in the book, and they each come to a different conclusion about sort of what to do with their lives based on what's happened over the course of the book. One, it has to do with having a daughter who has some special issues, and one, Amy finds that she's been a little naive about money. There are various things that happen. I think that I would like people to read this as a novel. For me, what novels do is observe closely, and then you can apply that to your own life, but maybe not literally.
And the book is quite seriously themed, but there are a lot of laugh-out-loud moments like this one. You don't mind if I read from your book, right?
I love it.
Nathaniel was older than anyone else Roberta knew and possessed a slightly bitter manner that was appealing to her because she did not yet know many older people and did not understand that this was a fairly common feature of them. So, in a dark kind of way, that's laugh-out-loud funny, a bitterness being associated with adulthood.
Look, this has to be a funny book and it has to be pleasurable to read. Otherwise, it's just one more book about this endless question, and I really, really didn't want to write that. I wanted to be entertaining as much as everything else.
In 2004, you wrote an article in the New York Times about how lack of space in your apartment forced you out into the city to work. You wrote on the M86 bus in doctors' waiting rooms, waiting to pick up your kid from a birthday party. Do you still write that way?
I was just writing a little bit in your waiting room, actually, before this started. I think, as I said...
And it's not even a waiting room.
It's not even a waiting room.
It's a chair outside the door in a busy hallway.
Right, exactly. I really love to sort of work, you know, when I can get it, where I can get it. And I love squeezing it in around the edges of things. You know, a kid needs to study for a geography test. I'm there to do it. Well, not any kid. My kids, so don't call in about that. You know, I'm there to do it as long as then I can find my time a little later, wherever it is and whenever it is.
Do you carry around a laptop or do you write in a notebook?
I carry around my Mac. Yes, my laptop. It's always with me with its little white blinking light.
Carol in Park Slope. You're on WNYC with Meg Wolitzer. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I've thought a lot about this issue of how women think of themselves, what their identity is. And I'm one of those women who needed to be out at work, needed to think of myself as a worker, as a progressive, as a social worker, community activist. But I didn't have a child till I was 41, and it was, you know, the joy of my life. But I stayed home for 4 months. I mean, I would have lost my job if I hadn't gone back, but I went back 3 days a week. And he went to daycare from the time he was 2. And he's 21 now, and he's pretty okay. But I've never judged the women who choose to stay home as a mother. You know, their identity is different. It's primarily more as a mother, I think, than I was. And maybe it had to do with the fact that my mother always worked. In fact, she was the only one in our building in the Bronx in the 40s and 50s. All the other mothers were home.
So for you, at least, your sense of your own personal needs dovetailed with your sort of political or social view of the world.
Absolutely.
Because I think where a lot of mothers come into conflict, and I think Amy Lamb, the protagonist in your book, Meg, is maybe one of them, it's that it's not that cut and dry.
No, it's never
right. Those
easy.
Identities are really in conflict with each other.
Yeah, it's not like there's this one sphere called work and this one sphere called home. It's more like a Venn diagram, if you remember those from math class. Things overlap. Work doesn't end when you leave the office. Motherhood doesn't end when you go to work. It all is very amorphous, and I think I wanted to show that.
I know a novelist who likes to hole up in the country for months at a time and write and write and write and gets a lot of writing done that way. You were just talking about, needing to go out. You were forced out in that 2004 article onto the M86 bus everywhere, our waiting room. How important is what you see on the streets and in restaurants and on public transportation and in our waiting room? Does it wind up in your novels for the most part, or is it, you know, all stuff that you're trying to tune out so you can write from your head?
It's a weird combination of both. On the one hand, it's a kind of muzak. It's a kind of background you're supposed to just listen to, tie a yellow ribbon, and kind of not really hear it. The muzak people don't want you to really hear it. They want you to sort of absorb it. So I think what I'm doing when I'm writing in a coffee shop is I'm aware of felt life around me, and that somehow informs what I'm doing. But I'm not writing Waitress, a novel.
If you had an apartment with an office, which I gather you don't, is that right?
I don't.
You don't. All these years. And you're Meg Wolitzer, and you don't have an office in your apartment.
Well, you know, the thing is, really, for me, I like to write sort of sprawled out quite a bit, and an office and a desk wasn't the sort of, you know, primary thing for me. I really like sort of floating around.
Let's get one more caller in here. BJ and Elizabeth, you're on. Oh, two more. BJ and Child, you're on WNYC. Hello.
How are you doing today?
Okay.
I just want to bring up something Cyril Connolly said. I believe it was in Enemies of Promise, his book. He said, the death of the artist is a pram in the hallway. I have to say, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I'm a writer, but my day job used to be, you know, in sales. And to find the time to write is really difficult. Your guest mentioned when you see those eyes flutter on the children. But I'm a practicing Buddhist, so when those eyes flutter, I'm half-hour meditation in. It really is a juggling act, you know. But I find that this, because a lot of your callers have talked about feeling bad about being stay-at-home moms or stay-at-home dads. I think a lot of it has to do with your ego. And if you just let go of your ego, let people's opinions be their opinions. Oh, daddy's on the phone, buddy. That you end up in a good place, and you just try. You have to do the best that you can do.
BJ and Elizabeth multitasking about what he's talking. Multitasking as he's talking about multitasking.
I'm sorry about the kid, but you know what it is? It's great to have kids, but I think Cyril Connolly is true. Once you have the child, there's a little bit of the death of the artist, because sitting at home and watching those game shows and being able to have the free time whenever inspiration strikes you is a luxury that I, too, wish I could go back 10 years and jump in a time machine and relive it.
BJ, I have to leave it there because we're out of time. Death of the artist?
No, absolutely not. The artist revives again and again like Lazarus.
Certainly in your case. And Meg Wolitzer will be reading from The 10-Year Nap tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the McNally Robinson Bookstore. That's 50 Prince Street in Lower Manhattan. Meg Wolitzer, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. A wrinkle in the congestion pricing bill that you may not be aware of. It's called the Moral Rectitude Index. Stay with us.